This is Ahval Online, meeting point of accurate news and free comment on the current affairs of Turkey. Welcome to our podcast series.
This is Turkey Abroad. Joining me today from San Francisco is Giorgio Caffiero. He is the CEO of Gulf State Analytics. Giorgio, pleasure to have you.
Good to be with you.
So what I want to talk about today is some of the recent warm words that have been exchanged between Turkey's leader, President Erdogan, and Saudi Arabia's King Salman. And they had a phone call not too long ago where they announced that they would work towards improving bilateral relations between their countries. And then over the weekend, which came as a bit something of a surprise to some observers, the Saudi foreign minister said that relations with Turkey were, quote, warm and amicable. But this seems to have come a little bit out of the blue, considering in the last month we've seen the launching of the Saudi business boycott against Turkey, and a whole year in which Saudi Arabia has placed itself on the opposite side of Ankara in Syria, Iraq, and even in the Eastern Mediterranean. And, you know, of course, this week, too, we have the continuation of the trial for the suspects in the Jamal Khashoggi murder in Istanbul. So, Giorgio, what I want to ask you is, where do these sudden warm words come from, in your view, and what do they mean?
There are definitely many moving parts in the picture. I definitely do not want to subscribe to the notion that everything that happens in the world relates to the United States. Having said that, I can't help but conclude that the change of leadership in Washington is relevant to these developments in Saudi-Turkish relations that you just mentioned. Right now, the Saudi leadership has very serious concerns about Riyadh's relationship with Washington in the post-Trump era, which will begin early next year. The sort of free pass that Donald Trump gave Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman on a number of files, from the Khashoggi killing to the crisis in Yemen, the plight of a number of human rights activists within the kingdom, were all issues in which Trump was accused by his critics of sort of disregarding so-called American values. Biden, however, has vowed to bring these so-called American values back to U.S. foreign policy. As a candidate, he specifically called out Saudi Arabia for its human rights violations at home and the kingdom's crimes in Yemen as well. In fact, Biden used very strong language. He went as far as calling Saudi Arabia a pariah state. We should also remember that he served as vice president to Barack Obama, who, to certain degrees, in selective ways, put pressure on some GCC states when it came to human rights issues. As we recall, his administration, for example, put a hold on arms sales to Bahrain because of the way in which that government reacted to the events of 2011. During the Arab Spring. So from the perspective of certain Gulf states, most definitely Saudi Arabia, there's concerns that Biden might try to put pressure on these governments on a number of issues. Therefore, I think the leadership in Riyadh wants to try to sort of put in order relationships in the region. I think that the Saudis are not wanting to make all these concessions to Turkey, and they're still going to, realistically speaking, there's still going to be tension between Saudi Arabia and Turkey. But I think the Saudi leadership would like to try to ease the friction in Riyadh-Ankara relations. Now, at the same time, from the Turkish perspective, there are also interests in trying to work a little better with Saudi Arabia and also to try to ease the friction. There's been a debate in Ankara that's been going on for a little bit of time right now. This pertains to the new Saudi-UAE axis. Now, it's important to keep in mind that Turkey views the United Arab Emirates as its number one geopolitical foe in the Gulf, as well as the wider MENA region. So this debate in Ankara is over the following question. Can Saudi Arabia and the UAE be somewhat separated? Is this an axis that is going to remain very solid, or is it possible that tensions between Riyadh and Abu Dhabi would afford Ankara an opportunity to create some wedges between the Saudi kingdom and the Emirates in order to not end the alliance between Saudi and the UAE, but to try to bring Saudi Arabia a little bit closer to Turkey's orbit of influence at the expense of the UAE's clout in the region? So I think these recent warm words between the two governments in Turkey and Saudi Arabia signals a continuation of Ankara's efforts to try to bring Saudi Arabia a little bit away from the UAE and closer to Ankara. It's important to note how some ideological factors are in play. So to be sure, Saudi Arabia is in a bloc of Arab states that is anti-Islamist, anti-Muslim Brotherhood. The Saudi government designated the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization officially back in 2014. That has been very relevant to problems in Saudi-Turkish relations over the past couple of years. Now, having said that, the Saudis in practice are less rigid in their anti-Muslim Brotherhood position than the UAE. And because of this, and in addition to other factors as well, the relationship between Turkey and Saudi Arabia never deteriorated to the extent that Turkish-Emirati relations have deteriorated. So I would, in sum, say that there's not going to be a smooth, easy, or even amicable relationship between Turkey and Saudi Arabia anytime soon. For a number of reasons that maybe we can get into later, there is a lack of trust between Riyadh and Ankara. But I do think that throughout the remainder of 2020 and into 2021 and beyond, as we move ahead into the post-Trump period, there certainly is potential for the Saudi and Turkish governments to somewhat ease friction in relations and possibly even find some areas where interests align and provide an opportunity for some sort of cooperation.
You know, it does seem like this relationship is almost defined by this constellation of external characters involved, whether it's the United Arab Emirates or the United States. But I'd like to focus on just the U.S. and get that out of the way first. And because when Trump lost, many commentators were saying that we're bunching Turkey and Saudi Arabia into a similar category as countries that have some of the most to lose without Trump in the White House, considering everything you mentioned on how Trump has given Mohammed bin Salman a bit of a blank check to pursue his policies across the region, and then what Congress sees as Trump protecting Turkey from sanctions over Syria or the S-400. And Biden has had his own choice words for Turkey and Erdogan as well during the campaign. And Biden took a step further this week when he named his national security and foreign policy team, who also share some similar views on both countries. So what I'm going to ask is, how do you think, if Biden and his team stick to the line that they took during the campaign, this tougher line with Saudi Arabia and Turkey, how is that totally affecting their considerations to one another for Turkey and Saudi Arabia? You answered it a bit before, but the U.S. factor seems to weigh very, very heavily over both countries.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. What a number of experts contended is that the Turkish government, and specifically the Turkish president, wanted to see Trump win this month's election, and that Biden's win was not received as very positive news in Ankara. The reasons are sort of obvious. You know, Biden has criticized the Turkish government on human rights issues. The Turkish-Russian defense relationship is also an area that Biden and almost everyone in Washington, with the exception of Donald Trump, has taken issue with. So I think the Turkish government has good reasons to worry about how the Biden presidency could impact U.S.-Turkey relations. Not lost in the equation is the fact that Biden was the vice president when the 2016 coup attempt took place. I don't think we're going to rehash every single aspect of that situation on your show, but what we can say is that there's a widespread consensus among Turks that the U.S. had some sort of a hand in that coup attempt, and the way the Obama administration reacted to it made many Turks, from those in government to just average citizens on the street, very angry at the United States. But even more important than the coup attempt, in terms of problems in U.S.-Turkey relations, was the Obama administration's decision to begin supporting the YPG in Syria. So there is a lot of baggage from the Obama years that are going to be very relevant to the way in which Turkey looks at Biden, given that he was the VP for those 8 years. Having said all of that, my opinion is that Turkey will also be able to find ways to benefit from Biden's presidency. I would not say that about Saudi Arabia. I think for Saudi Arabia, there is probably nothing to lose from Biden's presidency. And from the Saudi perspective, the best outcome would be just minimal losses and the costs not being as great as maybe some expect. Whereas in the case of Turkey, as I said, I think there are some areas where Biden's policies could actually advance Turkish interests. For example, when we look at the situation in Idlib and we look at what Blinken has said about this part of Syria, he has said that it is in the U.S. national interest to keep Idlib under the control of rebels. Obviously, that aligns with Turkey's interests, too. So neither a Biden administration or the Turkish government would want to see Assad's government take back every inch of Idlib. Also, when it comes to Libya, I think there's good reason to think that Biden might assert U.S. influence in that country much more so than Trump did. Of course, that's really not saying much because Trump, for all intents and purposes, made the U.S. a non-player in Libya after his presidency began in 2017. But I think Biden might try to do more to flex U.S. muscle in Libya in support of the Tripoli-based government, which has been able to survive pretty much just because of Turkish military intervention. So that's also another example. We can also bring up the blockade of Qatar. There's good reason to think the Biden administration might start putting some pressure on the blockading states to lift or at least ease the siege of Doha. Turkey would definitely welcome that development, as Ankara has played a critical role in terms of helping Qatar stand strong against this pressure from its neighbors on the Arabian Peninsula. And more generally, I think Biden is going to want to try to push back against Russia's geopolitical ascendancy more so than the Trump administration ever tried to do. And I don't think the Biden administration would really see Saudi being so much of a bulwark against Russia in regional hotspots. But a Biden administration, I think, would view its NATO, the U.S.'s NATO ally, Turkey, as a player that could effectively push back against Russia's hand in Libya, Syria, and possibly some other hotspots in the MENA region, South Caucasus as well. So some, I think for Turkey, the picture is sort of complicated about what the Biden presidency means, some ups and downs from Ankara's perspective. But again, for the Saudi kingdom, I just don't see any issues where they would see themselves as benefiting from the end of Trump's presidency.
You know, you also mentioned in the beginning, in response to the first question about how, from Turkey's perspective, Saudi Arabia is, of course, a rival, but secondary to the United Arab Emirates. And we saw back at the UN General Assembly where the Emirates' foreign minister bunched Turkey in with Iran as having imperial designs on the region. They support Haftar in eastern Libya. They stood by France against Erdogan over political Islam. And just this week, they also concluded a mutual defense pact with Greece, who they also sent planes to earlier in the fall to take part in exercises on Crete. So I want to, this is something that interests me a lot, but what is the difference in the threat perceptions for the Emirates and Saudi Arabia that they can go in these separate directions? Because as Saudi Arabia seems to be moving towards de-escalating with Turkey, we saw similar kind of efforts on the part of the Emiratis, but towards Iran. What influences them to be able to go these two directions in the region?
Saudi Arabia and the UAE are two different countries, and while their interests often align in many instances, there are also those in which they simply do not align. I think by and large, there's a vision that Riyadh and Abu Dhabi have for the Middle East, which is, you know, shaped by many common denominators, but at the same time, they have different strategies, different tactics, different priorities that lead to these instances where they seem to be going in different directions. The most visible example of this has to do with the situation in southern Yemen, where the UAE is giving a lot of support to the Southern Transitional Council, a separatist group that is very anti-Muslim Brotherhood, very anti-Turkey. And the Saudis, on the other hand, are giving support to the UN-recognized government in Yemen, whose forces have been fighting the STC for quite a while now, with actually violence resuming earlier this month. So yes, when it comes to threat perceptions of Iran and Turkey, I think Saudi Arabia and the UAE are on slightly different pages. Something I believe, where I do have a disagreement with a number of other analysts, but I really do believe that right now Abu Dhabi sees Turkey as a graver threat than it sees Iran. I don't think that's true for Saudi Arabia. I think Saudi Arabia sees Iran as a graver threat than Turkey. So interestingly, what I think we're sort of seeing is Saudi Arabia trying to approach Turkey in some more pragmatic ways. Again, I don't want to overstate it. There are big problems between Saudi Arabia and Turkey, but I think Riyadh wants to sort of compartmentalize those problems in ways which are actually pretty similar to how the UAE has been trying to approach Iran since really, I would say, you should go back to about the summer of 2019 when we started seeing a much more diplomatic approach to the Islamic Republic on the part of Abu Dhabi. I don't think that these differences in foreign policy are going to lead to any sort of a divorce between Saudi Arabia and the UAE. These two GCC states are so important to each other. The Crown Prince of Abu Dhabi has a very, very close relationship to the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, whom, as far as I'm concerned, is set to become the next king of Saudi Arabia. And given his age, he could be on the throne for many, many decades. But at the same time, I think we will see a continuation of these instances in which Abu Dhabi and Riyadh move in some slightly different directions.
One of the episodes that I think I'd like to focus on also on that, that I think embodies kind of all of the players here, is the Qatar boycott, because also earlier this week, the Saudi foreign minister had spoken about keeping the door open to more communications with the Qataris as well. and seeking a way to end the dispute. But then the Emirati officials came out and said the complete opposite. They said that they don't really see any progress on the part of Qatar, or in some cases, they think that with Trump gone, Qatar is doubling down on its resistance to diplomacy. And on tomorrow, on Thursday, Turkey and Qatar hosting their sixth round of strategic talks to deepen their ties further. So, if they're able to grow closer together and we see something of a Saudi-Turkish reapproachment, combined with, of course, a Biden administration that's interested in it, do you think that that would be enough to encourage an end to the boycott of Qatar, or do you think and the UAE having a veto on that is enough to stop that?
Excellent question. I think that the possibility of Saudi Arabia easing the blockade on Qatar, even if not lifting it entirely, is definitely on the table. As we mentioned, Saudi Arabia has some huge concerns about its PR in Washington. The fact that the CIA found the Crown Prince to be guilty of ordering Khashoggi's killing, and from Washington's perspective, the UAE is not implicated in that case. From Washington's perspective as well, the UAE left Yemen in 2019. So the Emirates had their Abraham Accords, making the UAE and Israel's relationship formalized. That did a lot to boost the UAE's image among lawmakers on both sides of the partisan divide in Washington. All of this is to say that Saudi Arabia has to worry a lot more about its relationship with the Biden administration than the UAE. So something that experts have considered is that the Saudis might reconcile with Qatar in order to buy some goodwill with the Biden administration. It would be seen as a relatively easy concession for the Saudis to make. There is even polling data that showed that the majority of Saudi citizens would favor a compromise with Qatar if that could lead to a restoration of diplomatic and economic relations. So it would not be like the Saudis reconciling with the Syrian government or signing a peace accord with Israel, because those two moves could lead to some sort of a backlash from Saudi society or religious authorities in the kingdom. Reconciling with Qatar would not risk such domestic unrest inside the kingdom. So even if the Saudis would do that, though, you still have the question about whether the UAE would follow suit. I don't see that happening. The UAE's perception of the alleged Qatari threat is very ideological. The hardline stance that the UAE has taken against Qatar is very, very rigid. It would be very difficult for me to imagine U.S. pressure resulting in the UAE restoring its relations with Qatar. To the point, I think we should really consider the possibility of the anti-Qatar bloc sort of dividing between Saudi Arabia and perhaps some other members of the group of blockading states restoring relations with Qatar, and then others, probably the UAE and Egypt as well, deciding to continue with their hardline position against Doha.
And we could probably see Turkey being, of course, favorable towards any wider effort to even ease that blockade on Qatar. Also, can't we? Especially if, as you also mentioned, it's something that's an interest in Washington and something that they could probably collaborate on together. Especially if Turkish Saudi ties warm a bit along the way.
Yeah, and it definitely would serve Turkey's interest in sort of a longer term sense too. You know, in between the first Gulf crisis of 2014 and the current one, which broke out in 2017, there was the establishment of a Turkish military base, a joint Turkish-Qatari military base, if I remember correctly, in Qatar. And after the blockade began, the Turks deployed a number of their forces to the base to sort of strengthen the Turkish military muscle on the ground, which, along with the presence of the U.S. military at Al Udeid, did serve as an effective deterrence. It quickly brought off the table the possibility of some sort of Saudi invasion or annexation of Qatar that some said could have possibly been comparable to Russian actions in eastern Ukraine. That was something that people in Qatar were genuinely worried about in the early hours of the siege. And Turkey, as I said, it did a lot to bolster to help Qatar and to give Doha greater confidence in its policy of refusing blockading states' demands. So if the blockade ultimately were to end, or at least the Saudi blockade were to end without Qatar having to make any concessions, that would send out a message about the effectiveness of Turkey as an ally of Arab countries. And that would certainly be noted in Arab capitals all over the region. And it would definitely add credibility to Turkey's talk about being a real force in the Arab world to contend with.
My last question is going to, it has to touch on the ongoing Khashoggi trial that's continued this week in Istanbul, because it was brought up a few times shortly after his murder that Turkey saw it as a way to divide the crown prince in Saudi Arabia from his father, King Salman. And Erdogan has also had separate rhetoric directed at each one of them, where he appealed to the king directly during the aftermath of Khashoggi's death, almost like reaching over the head of his son. And then even at the G20 conference, in his remarks, he described him as, if I remember correctly, my dear brother. And it does seem like after what happened with Khashoggi, the crown prince has had no choice but to kind of step into the background a bit more. And this could be important for Turkey, considering MBS was the one who was responsible for organizing the Saudi effort to boycott Qatar, and then even getting Saudi Arabia more involved in Libya alongside the Emirates. If I'm wrong, there was even a report in the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times that was suggesting the crown prince helped persuade Trump to consider taking that call with Haftar last summer as well. So does this in any way suggest to you, Giorgio, that the prince's say on Turkey policy is now being more weakened, and King Salman is trying to take more control over some of Saudi Arabia's foreign policy, not the region itself, is changing even beyond Turkey?
There are many people debating what's actually going on here in terms of the dossiers that supposedly the crown prince is responsible for and those which his father, King Salman, are responsible for. As you correctly point out, since the Khashoggi killing, the president of Turkey, President Erdogan, has maintained a very respectful relationship with King Salman. This is despite some serious friction in bilateral relations between these two countries rising quite a bit. King Salman is the custodian of the two holy mosques, and Erdogan has never at any point implied that the Saudi king had anything to do with Khashoggi's killing. So there have been these phone calls between the two ever since that killing took place in October 2018, in which Erdogan has showed his respect and made it clear that his issue with Saudi Arabia vis-a-vis the Khashoggi affair has to do with Mohammed bin Salman and not the king. And then there are many people who speculate that certain things the Saudis do were done without the king being informed, and then other things were done because of the king's decision. So as an outsider, it's sometimes difficult to understand what kind of power the crown prince actually has in relation to his father. A number of experts disagree about this. But regardless of these debates that are going on, what is clear is that the king is not going to be alive forever, and that at some point, perhaps before too long, he will pass away. And I think there's every reason to assume that Mohammed bin Salman will become the next king of Saudi Arabia, and that thus he will become officially the custodian of the two holy mosques. How that's going to play out in Saudi-Turkey relations, I don't know. But as I have mentioned before in this conversation, while we could see some easing of friction between the two countries, there are really serious problems between Riyadh and Ankara. And I think the relationship is going to be difficult for both sides to manage after Mohammed bin Salman becomes the king. Erdogan, at that point, will have no choice but to either engage with Mohammed bin Salman or not. And if he chooses not to, that's going to be a really, really big stumbling block to any sort of rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Turkey. So the picture is unclear. I do think that relations between these two countries can move in different directions. I do believe that it would bode well for regional stability if these two countries could reconcile somewhat, and maybe if there is a little bit more balance in Saudi Arabia's foreign policy between the UAE and Turkey. But, you know, also another factor we should bring up here is that Abu Dhabi does have quite a bit of influence over Riyadh, and the Emirati leadership does not want to see Saudi Arabia become friendly toward Turkey. So there are also levers that Abu Dhabi has, which it can use to undermine and dim the prospects for a warmer relationship between Riyadh and Ankara. So, you know, time will tell, but I think we've definitely hit on some of the important moving parts in the picture here.
Giorgio Caffiero, it's been a pleasure to have you on Turkey Abroad today, and I hope to have you back sometime soon to talk further about Turkey and its interactions in the Gulf.
Absolutely. The pleasure is all mine. Thank you so much.
My name is Nicholas Morgan, and this is Turkey Abroad.
You can follow Ahval News Online podcast series through Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, and Spreaker. All you need to know about Turkey is here for your ears, mind, and attention. Thank you for listening to our podcast.